It's good to be back this morning after our family trip out west, a trip that saw us back in Waterloo at a nice and early 4:30 in the morning on Monday after a four-hour delay at the airport. Despite the delay in our return, we had a lovely trip, although we packed so much in that we have been feeling like this week has been a week of recovery, trying to catch up on sleep after the busy Christmas season and after our trip that capped off the season and after our early morning return. Having moved through the Christmas season as a congregation too, this morning we find ourselves in a season of afters. After Advent, after Christmas, after Epiphany. In fact, the church's liturgical calendar, the Sundays that follow Epiphany and precede Lent are simply called After Epiphany, which we celebrated last Sunday. Perhaps we're also feeling like we're still trying to get our bearings straight as a congregation after all these afters. Maybe a key question we should ask this morning is, how should all that has happened over the last month or so continue to impact us? Although Advent, Christmas, and Epiphany are in the past for us, perhaps we need to find a way to dwell longer with the questions and the answers of the season we've rushed through, even though it might be easy for that to happen in the busy return to our schedules. One way that the Worship Planning Committee thought we might be able to dwell a bit longer with the significance of the Advent and Christmas season, with the season in which we wait for and then proclaim God's coming among us in Jesus, is to plan a worship series that draws us deeper into the big picture of the family stories that precede Jesus' birth. We can all relate to family stories in one way or another. We all have some kind of family story, no matter what or how diverse our family structures might be, or who we consider our family to be. Family stories are also undoubtedly complicated, characterized by a mixture of beauty and brokenness. This is something we often become especially aware of during the Christmas season. And yet we're not alone in this. This mixture of beauty and brokenness is present in the many family stories that prepared the way for Jesus' birth, too. These families, ranging from the patriarch Abraham and the matriarch Sarah, and leading all the way to Joseph and Mary, had their own moments of beauty and brokenness. Author Joanna Herrader has written a powerful Advent devotional on the family history, the genealogy of Jesus, and more specifically of the women in that genealogy who prepared the way for Jesus. And the devotional is called Expecting Emmanuel. And in it, she seeks to attend to the stories of women who are listed in the genealogy of Jesus in such a way as to consider how their humanity connects with ours, how God is present with us all, and what it means to claim that the Divine One became human in the infant Jesus. It's a powerful devotional, one that is worth attending to and that I highly recommend, even in this season of afters that we find ourselves in. I pray that as we consider the stories of five women in the genealogy of Jesus, that we might indeed discern how each woman's humanity connects with ours and how God is present with us all and what it means to say that God has come to us in Jesus. This morning in the playfully performed Matthew's Begats, we got the broad sweep of Jesus' genealogy as it appears in Matthew chapter 1, verses 1 through 16. For the remainder of my sermon this morning, however, we're going to focus on verse 3 of that genealogy, where we encounter the family of Judah, who is the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. By Tamar. This designation, and yep, great, that's good, Jaren. If you could actually go one more slide down, maybe. Oh, okay, that's good. Yep, right there. This designation by Tamar, along with the designation of other women in Jesus' genealogy, should stand out to readers. Why? Because often biblical genealogies didn't include women, a feature of genealogies that is grounded in the broader legacy of patriarchy. The social system in which the father or eldest male head of the family, is head of the family and through whom descent is traced. A reality that continues today in many ways. The social system of patriarchy had far-reaching effects beyond just the fact that with it, descent was traced through the men of the family, however. Patriarchy as a social system that was explicitly operative in biblical times and continues in various ways today, ensured that men owned most of the land and passed it on to their male progeny, and that men occupied most positions of political, religious, and judicial power in society. Women in this system were economically dependent on men, were in a position of significant disadvantage, socially speaking, and often were confined to the management of home and family life, although even there, they would have to cede authority to the husband or father. Furthermore, as many of the patriarchal narratives of Scripture make excruciatingly clear, the well-being and social status of women were often dependent on their ability to bear children, especially male children, to carry forward the line of male descent. Much of the way the scriptural story unfolds is impacted by the social system of patriarchy, a social system that the Bible's authors shared with societies of all kinds. It was not unique in that way. Some take the Bible's implicit acceptance of patriarchy as somehow endorsing it as a social system, or claiming that it was set up that way by divine design. But as Jewish scholar Tikva Frymer-Kensky notes, the authors of many of the biblical narratives and laws did not so much seek to justify or construct patriarchy as they simply assumed it, much like they assumed other institutions that we would question today, like slavery. Perhaps the most interesting fact, however, one that Frymer-Kensky also notes, is that despite the fact that the Bible's authors were squarely situated in their own time and place and operated with their own social assumptions about the rightness of patriarchy, they also found themselves frequently pushing against the status quo and telling stories that claimed that God elevates the lowly, brings the marginalized to the center, and raises high the socially inferior. There's a tension, then, in many of the Bible's stories, a tension between the social systems that propped up the status quo and those who challenged that status quo as they followed God. A tension between the social systems that ignored and suppressed the worth of some in society and those who recognized and elevated the worth of the disadvantaged in society. As we read the stories of these women in the Bible, including Tamar's today, this tension is very apparent. Speaking of which, it's about time we turn to Tamar's story. And Jaron, I'll get you, actually, if you could come back. You've been running ahead, I think. Sorry. Can you go back one more? Okay, we'll just leave it there for now. A bit of background info might be helpful. Tamar's name appears within the larger narrative of Jacob's children. So now we can go to the next slide, Jaron. That's great. Through his wives, Leah and Rachel. One of Leah's sons was Judah, and one of Rachel's sons was Joseph. Judah, you might recall, was the brother who, after Joseph was thrown in the pit, suggested that he and his other jealous brothers sell Joseph into slavery. And of course, we read in Genesis 37 that they did just that. Well, the next chapter begins by saying that after this incident, Judah left his brothers and his family home to begin a new life elsewhere. And initially, it would appear that Judah does quite well for himself. And you can transition the slide, Jaron. Next one. There we go. Yep. He meets new friends when he leaves home, including an Adullamite man named Hirah, and also meets a Canaanite man named Shua, along with his daughter, whom Judah later took to be his wife. Throughout the whole story of Judah that we read, Judah's wife is left unnamed. She's the daughter of Shua. We're then told that Judah's wife bears him three sons, Onan, and Shelah, a sign that God has blessed Judah. Three sons. Tamar enters the story seemingly from out of nowhere when we learn that once little has grown up, Judah took a wife for him, and that wife's name was Tamar. Jaron, if you could There we go. Transition the slide now. There we go. A quick note about the name Tamar, from which the more familiar name Tamara or Tamara comes. It means date palm tree, and it was a tree known to bear wonderful fruit and lots of it. Already, it seems, Judah has seemed to have had a fruitful life apart from his father's house, with starting a family elsewhere and having three kids, and now he hopes his son Ur will carry on the pattern of fruitfulness through his marriage to Tamar. As Tikva Frymer-Kensky notes, however, while Tamar's name suggests the possibility of fertility and so potential to carry on Judah's lineage through his son Ur, this fertility is not assured. Direct and intentional action is needed to ensure that Tamar, like a date palm, will indeed bear fruit. The rest of Tamar's story outlines the central problem as it concerns Judah. Will he have grandchildren born through Tamar and carry on his line? And as it concerns Tamar, will she bear children and so secure for herself the very limited amount of social and economic power and status that she can have? When problems appear, immediately. Judah's son, Ur, we are told, bluntly, was wicked in God's sight. And before any child can be conceived between Ur and Tamar, Genesis says, the Lord put him to death. Okay. Now Tamar's a widow. I'm sorry, I printed this on a sheet on top of text by mistake. So now I'm trying to read this here. I'm trying to be, you know, mindful of reusing paper. Right, so now Judah's line is in jeopardy. Okay. I'm going to go off my slides. Let's go. Yeah. Okay. So this is a problem, right? It's a problem for Judah. It's a problem for Tamar. But there was a solution for this problem. There was an institution in Israelite law at that time called the Levirate Institution. Basically, when brothers, so there's Ur, Onan, and Shelah, when they reside together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased is not going to be married outside the family to a stranger. Rather, her husband's brother shall perform the duty of the husband, of a husband's brother to her, and the firstborn whom she bears shall succeed to the name of the deceased brother, so that his name may not be blotted out. Okay, so there's a provision here to ensure that Ur's line will carry on through Tamar, even though it's Onan stepping in. Onan, however, is greedy. He knows that if he carries out this role, that he stands to it personally inherit less, because now Ur's line will continue and Ur's child will inherit more of the funds. So Onan takes steps to ensure that Tamar does not get pregnant. Well, for this wickedness, can you guess what happens? Yep, he is put to death also. So now things get really complicated, don't they? Because from the outside looking in, Judah is seeing his sons, one by one, dying off, and he's not sure for what reason, other than that he knows that Tamar is the one commonality. Unfortunately, he did not have the sight to recognize the wickedness of his sons. At this point, Judah has a few options within Israelite law himself. First, he can have one of his one remaining son, Shelah, perform the Levirate. The ensuing narrative would suggest that Shelah was still a bit too young at that time for that, but Tamar could have been asked to wait for him to be old enough. Second, however, it was also legal for Judah in this special circumstance to act as Levirate. Third, Judah could release Tamar from his family, thus allowing for the provision of her future economic security within another family. Well, Judah takes none of these options, although he pretends to take the first. He tells Tamar, go home to your father's house and live as a widow and wait for Shelah to grow up. Judah's true motive is clear, however. He doesn't want Shelah to marry Tamar because he's afraid Shelah will die too. And Judah also refuses to perform the Levirate himself, possibly on account of the same fear. notice what happens to Tamar in all of this. She's sent home a widow, but she's not a true widow because she's still linked to Judah's family and must wait for him to decide her fate. She has no recourse to find a life outside of Judah's family, and yet Judah refuses to give her an option for inclusion in the family. If she tries to seek a life outside of Judah's line, she faces violence, even death. What action can Tamar take at this point? The reader is left to wonder whether she will live up to her name. And then we come to the moment in the story where Tamar takes control of her fate, where she acts and stands up for herself in the way she could within the constraints of her time. We learn that after a long time had passed and it was clear that Judah was never going to have Shelah perform the levirate, Tamar got news that her mother-in-law, Judah's wife, had passed away. Furthermore, she was told that Judah was going to be shearing his sheep not far off from where Tamar was living. And so she hatched a bold plan. If her father-in-law would not have his son perform his duty, and if he himself would not perform his duty, then Tamar would take action to ensure that he did, even if he didn't know he was doing it. And so she took off her widow's garments, concealed her face, and sat at the gate, ironically called the Eye Opener, knowing that Judah would pass by there. Judah saw her and assumed she was a prostitute and propositioned her. She accepted, on the condition that he give her something in return. Judah suggests a goat from the flock, and while she accepts, she asks for a pledge to hold on to until he sends the goat, to ensure that he will be true to his word. Judah asks what kind of pledge would be sufficient, and she suggests his seal, cord, and staff, which Framer Kensky notes is the equivalent of Judah's credit card. Leave your credit card. The deal was made, and the deed was done. So now what? Upon returning home, Judah stands by his pledge. Thank you, Jaron, for automatically knowing where I'm going here. Judah stands by his pledge, so he sends someone with a goat from his flock to bring it to the place where he assumed this prostitute frequented, although she was nowhere to be found. Judah is confused, but says, hey, I lived up to my end of the bargain. That's on her if she wasn't there to collect, and assumes the rest is history. Except then, 3 months later, Judah gets notice that his daughter-in-law, Tamar, is pregnant. And the assumption is that this was due to shameful, faithless acts. Judah's judgment is swift as he calls for her, the supposedly unrighteous one, to be burned. But as Tamar is eventually brought out, she sends word to her father-in-law, along with his seal and cord and staff, saying, take note and recognize, please, whom these belong to. And upon seeing these items, Judah now has his eyes opened. He recognizes not only these items, but he recognizes that he has been the unrighteous one in all this, that the shame is all his, and that Tamar has been righteous. He says, she is more in the right than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah. The end of Tamar's story, as the biblical narrative tells it, comes with the birth of her twin boys, Peretz and Zerah. As Framer Kensky notes, Judah applauds Tamar's action and God rewards it. Her boldness, initiative, and willingness to defy society's expectations have enabled God to provide Judah with two new sons after the death of his first two sons. How does Tamar's story stir our imaginations today? What questions does she ask of us? I hope we can talk about this in worship response time, and I'll be there for that. But for now, let me suggest a few thoughts. Tamar lived in a world of societal and familial obstacles. Patriarchy was a major one, but there were many. Her story is a story told a billion times since, women in lower positions of power needing to do what they could to stand up for themselves and make a future for themselves in what is often a cruel world. One of the key themes in Tamar's story was the theme of recognition, being seen, seen as a human being whose full humanity mattered. In her devotional, Expecting Emmanuel, Joanna Herrader begins by saying, "To believe in the incarnation, that God became human in the person of Jesus, is to believe that humanity matters. It is to take our humanity and the humanity of others seriously, to hold it tenderly, to consider it honestly. If the Word truly became flesh, then attending to human emotions, human bodies, and human stories can help us understand the strangely present power of God in our all too human lives." Might I suggest with Herrader that one of the challenges that Tamar's story continues to press upon us today is the challenge to recognize with seriousness, tenderness, and honesty the humanity of those around us, especially those who are in disadvantaged positions in our communities and in our world. And might I also suggest that Tamar's boldness and courage is an example to us all, calling us to stand up for ourselves and for others when structural sins and evils aim to push us and others down or unjustly shame them. May it be so. May we be bold like Tamar and stand up for the worth and dignity of those made in the image of God, the image of Emmanuel, God with us in the lowly. Amen.